Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There's a bill circulating at the state capitol that would allow Californians to change the way they spell their names on official documents like marriage, birth, and death certificates. We commonly refer to them as accents, but they are known as diacritical marks, which are marks placed above, below, or sometimes even next to a letter to indicate a particular pronunciation. For example, you may see an accent on the name Gonzalez, like mine, to emphasize a certain syllable of the name. In the case of Assembly Bill 77, a Sacramento area family says their son, Nicolas, who has an accent on the A, was the inspiration behind bringing the bill to Assemblymember Blanca Pacheco. His parents say that with an ethnic name, it should be able to write and also document that name in the way that it's supposed to be pronounced. But the state has had some issues with adapting to this change, so the family is hoping to make it a law. Joining us to talk about AB 77 are Nancy Chaires Espinoza and Pablo Espinoza, the parents of Nicolas. Good morning. Thanks for seeing. Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us.
The parents of Nicolas.
Nicolas. Thank you. That is the subject of this entire.
As he would say, he said in front of the legislature when he testified with his mother, Nancy. I think you may know one of the youngest people testifying on the state assembly. At 6 years old, he said, you know, I want my name is Nicolas with a tilde. I want to write my name right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Nicolas. And this starts when Nicolas was just a few months old, right? This isn't the first time that both of you have attempted this at the state capitol. Why is this issue so important to you?
You know, it's very important for our son to be able to carry his full identity into life, into society, right? And our names are such a big part of our identity. They're the first thing people learn about us often. So the idea that, you know, he's going to have to correct the pronunciation because people don't see the tilde routinely. And the fact that without the tilde, it's also stripped of its cultural heritage, it's really important to us. And, we just think that our son and other kids, other people should be able to really represent their names accurately.
Right. I mean, because it would be Nicholas as opposed to Nicolas, right? And the accent is very important.
Well, Nicholas, if it's spelled C-K, right? But even more so, if it's spelled correctly, but without the diacritical mark, it will be Nicolas. Mm. And the thing about what Nancy talks about, identity and heritage, you know, at his early age of six, but even before that, he says, you know, tengo sangre de tres sitios. I have blood of three different places. You know, his grandparents are from Jalisco, Mexico. I was born in Ecuador, and he was born here. And he's proud of every single one of those three. And I think to also be proud of the United States, where, you know, you grow up looking at this country as a place, as a beacon of change. We shouldn't be afraid of this change, which is not really massive. Eight other states are already doing it. So it is incredibly important, as Nancy says.
I love that at just 6 years old, your son is already thinking about such big, really kind of deep, meaningful things of his identity and where he came from and the generations before him.
You know, for all kids, I think there's an age-appropriate way to teach them about how to be respectful of other people's cultures. So those are kind of the lessons that he's living out and that he's practicing right now. It's about setting the table so that we treat all cultures with equal respect. You know, I don't want that my friends who are O'Connells and O'Donnells lose their ability to accurately write their names on their vital records. I just want the rest of us to be able to share in that.
Yeah. And this isn't just about Nicolas. It's about there's a wider community. What are you hearing from other families and other just individuals who would like these diacritical marks on their official documents?
Well, you know, it was actually Nancy that brought it up to me that, hey, did you know that is, you know, Vietnamese and Hmong, they use something very similar as accents. And you were telling me, Nancy, it's on their most popular boys and girls names. And much like in Spanish, without it, not only does it change the pronunciation, but it can also change the meaning. I was talking to a Greek friend of mine who was telling me the name of his daughter. It would also have it on Greek. And I go, if you had the opportunity, would you like to use the accent? He says, of course. I never knew about that. We have never talked about that. Mm-hmm. And I guess much like Nancy and I, you don't know until you know. We didn't know it was illegal when they told us, no, sorry, you can't put the accent on Nicolas. We thought it was a joke. And then it turns out when they told us it was illegal, we were shocked.
Yeah.
And this is the second time you're trying to move this through the state capitol. The first time was in 2017. Nicolás was just a few months old. What happened the first time?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think there really was the robust discussion that the bill merited, right? The opposition came out and, you know, my understanding is the administration just felt, you know, kind of there was a nebulous cost out there that they may or may not have put a number in when it was in the Appropriations Committee. But there really wasn't a discussion about what would it take to get this done. Whereas this time, you know, we felt that the state has evolved since then. It's not a lot of years, but the conversation has continued to evolve about how to actually respect diversity and that is a shared value among leaders and lawmakers in California. So I am seeing a different conversation around this bill this time. It does seem, you know, even folks who raise concerns are at least joining the conversation about, OK, well, let's explore what it would actually require to get this done.
Very much so, because even that same organization that was opposed many years ago now, for the analysis on the very first legislative committee, the Assembly Health Committee, it says that they're opposed unless amended, which basically means that they're not opposed, but they have some suggestions as to how to implement it. And that is exactly a whole different conversation, like Nancy's saying.
Hmm. Given that this is already taking place in more than a half dozen states already in the country, what kind of lift is expected of California in terms of the technology to actually add these diacritical marks?
You know, I can't really speak with that with a great deal of authority. I understand really from the analysis of the bill done in the Health Committee that the technology differs a little bit at the county level, and that's one of the areas that's really being explored right now in terms of implementation. But I am a very, very proud Californian, right? And I love it when California leads. I think we're kind of spoiled in that way. We're used to this can-do attitude in California. And I just really and truly believe that in California, the technological leader that we are, that if, you know, seven other states have already been able to achieve this, frankly, I would be embarrassed that we could not.
Very much so. And if Utah can do it, that's the very last state. Heck, if Texas can do it, I'm sure Governor Gavin Newsom will love to find a way to have California do what Texas is already doing and what Florida is very much against. And technologically, there's absolutely ways of doing it. The chair of the Assembly Health Committee, Assemblymember Jim Wood, clarified to another member that California doesn't transmit the actual documents to the federal state. They transmit data. So when you're transmitting data, and again, I'm not a data expert, but at its most basic level, a mark is just one element of the data that can be very easily stricken out. And at the most basic level, the chair of the committee said, if there's such a complication, I have a box of Sharpies that I can provide to anybody that says that this is impossible.
And you have some other partnerships as well. One of the partnerships is the Spanish-speaking announcer for the Los Angeles Dodgers, also a Major League Hall of Famer himself, Jaime Jarrín. And he talked about how back in 2017 that actually baseball adopted this new set of rules to get the names and the pronunciation of the names of players correct, to get it right. So we're going to listen to part of what he had to say, and then we'll chat about his comments after.
It was 2017 when the Major League Players Association sponsored a campaign called Ponle Acento on the Major League's baseball, every club was asked to include in the daily game notes a page with translation and proper spelling, including the ñ of the Latino, European, and Asian players. Today, all Major League Baseball teams have interpreters, and the players' jerseys have their names using diacritical marks and accents. Adding punctuation marks to the written word in Spanish expands the beautiful and melodic language, the same result as a musical composer giving the opportunity to add sharps and flats to musical notes. But beyond punctuation, it is the ultimate sign of respect. Respect to the name, respect to the person, respect to the culture.
Yeah. In addition to that respect, I love how he compares this to adding a sharp or a flat to a piece of music to change the complexion of sound.
Absolutely. Mr. Jarin is a tough act to follow, especially in his own voice, but he really encapsulated
that. The moment that when he starts talking, I sit back and it's almost like he's going to be telling me a nighttime story. It's just so soothing.
Makes sense what he did for a career, does for her career, right?
And he's from my city, actually, from Quito, Ecuador. So, I mean, look, if Major League Baseball can be that progressive, you know, why not California? Hashtag ponle acento, put the accent on it, is what it was. And, you know, Vicky, one of the players that actually was the most forceful in pushing that was Adrian Gonzalez. He was a Dodger, iconic Dodger at the time in 2017.
Hmm. Yeah, and you know, following the MLB's lead, many other leagues, other professional sports have done the same thing. And this is, again, you know, I reflect on kind of that oddness about California generally being a leader and generally being progressive. But here is a case where we're actually behind the private sector.
Yeah. And the California and the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Mexican soap opera actress Angelica Maria, she asked for her star to be redone so it could include her accents. There's the latest Avatar movie actress Zoe Saldana. She has two. She has the ñ of her parents' name, Dominican, and the umlaut over the E from her marriage name, I believe. But anyhow, she also has written that she's reclaiming her name, because before, when she started, people were like, oh, it's too complicated, Saldana. People are not going to know how to pronounce it. So it goes to show, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you can't do it until we pass this bill.
Yeah, and also, I mean, by reclaiming that, it's also, I think, speaks to being disconnected from your culture and your history when you don't have diacritical marks or the correct pronunciation of your name, especially in a public setting like that.
Yeah, and you know, people don't make those decisions in isolation, right? It begins in school when, you know, maybe your teacher just decides, well, I'm going to call you something else because that's easier for me. Or, you know, maybe your parents had experiences like that. So we start to get these messages over time from different places that we have to leave parts of ourselves aside, you know, to engage in society. And that's really the message that the government sends when they say, well, we don't really care about what your what your name is accurately.
And it's great, though, that the new director of the California Department of Public Health shares in those feelings of pride, at least the way he displays that on the official website of the California Department of Public Health, under which, ironically, the vital records unit lies. His name is Dr. Tomás Aragón, with the accent on the A and the accent on the O. And, you know, he proudly displays that on the California Department of Public Health's website.
Hmm. Given that cost has been an issue in terms of the pushback for this bill in the past, how do you foresee the state implementing this if passed? I know that it's not necessarily your wheelhouse, but when addressing this now a second time through the state capitol, how do you hope the state takes in the incursion of cost and overcomes that?
I just hope there's a comprehensive and honest conversation about it. You know, I think, you know, we're all realistic about it. We know neither the folks on the state side or the county, you know, who would have to implement this have a money tree. We should all just get a great estimate as best as possible about what it would take and develop a plan to find the resources and the timeline to implement them. That, I think, is a fair conversation to have. What is not a fair conversation to have is just to say it would be too expensive, or it's not worth doing.
And also, the idea also is that it can also serve not only as a way of reflecting culture or values and all that stuff, but it can be a source of revenue for local governments. Mm-hmm. For parents like Nancy and I show, you know, this bill pass, and we decide that we want to have Nicolás with an accent on the A on his birth certificate, we can go and ask for a correction and pay a fee. And there are, you know, millions of Latinos in California, many more folks, Greek, French, German,
Vietnamese, Hebrew.
The list goes on and on.
That, you know, so if Nancy, like Nancy says, if there's a real discussion, we ought to also be looking at that it is part of the bill.
Are there any concerns about the inconsistencies at a state and a federal level, you know, in taking in a birth certificate, a death certificate, a marriage license compared to, you know, a passport or a social security card?
You know, I've heard that issue raised in this discussion, but again, six or seven other states are already doing this. So clearly a solution has already been identified to work around that issue.
Yeah, those states send the data, as the chair of the Assembly Committee on Public Health was saying, to the federal government without the diacritical marks. They're just separated. But hopefully, you know, knock on wood, California passes it and is a leader in the country, although we're behind a little bit. And other states and the federal government can look west and see that it can be done. And we can reach out to Senator Alex Padilla, who he says he grew up listening to Jaime Jarrín. And maybe we can have Don Jaime Jarrín have a conversation with him. And Congressman Jimmy Gomez, who somebody told me a story that when he was in elementary, he was told, you know, you have two choices. You can either be James or Jimmy, but you cannot be Jaime Gomez. Mm. What a horrible choice to give to a child.
It's terrible.
So let's just say that maybe Nico's bill can possibly hopefully make it, you know, out of the California legislature and the governor's desk and then onto D.C.
Yeah. I mean, my dad, as a kid, alternated between George and Jorge, right? So, I mean, that's just, I think that's so common across the state and even across the country. Finally, you two are parents. How has it been going through the legislative process? And what have you learned the first time that you're applying the second time?
Well, it is really different because the first time we tried this, our son was a baby, so he was present but couldn't really participate, whereas now we're able to have conversations with him about just really tying together the values we try to teach and live generally, which is, you know, if you see something wrong in the world, you should take part in trying to be part of the solution, right? If you see an injustice, you should try to fix it, not just for yourself, but for other people. And I'm really proud that he gets to really put that lesson into practice at such a young age.
And that is exactly what I always liked about Nancy, her love for public service. And I get emotional because my late mother used to tell me, you know, if you don't like something, don't sit on the sidelines complaining about it. You know, get up and do something about it. And you can do public service from wherever you are. I was a journalist in my current job. So public service is also, you know, using is not a horrible word, but having Nicolás be a symbol for other folks in the community and all of us understanding that we're doing it, of course, for Nicolás and for all of the Sofias and the Gonzalez and the Adrians of the world.
Nancy and Pablo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you so much.
What a fun and wonderful conversation. And that is Nancy Chaires Espinoza and Pablo Espinoza. They are talking to us about AB 77, which, if passed, would add diacritical marks on official documents like birth, death, certificates, as well as marriage licenses. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California's climate lives in extremes, the most variable in North America. The state experiences intense weather pattern changes from years of drought to record snowpack and rainfall. Normally, if you drive through the Central Valley, you're surrounded by sprawling agricultural fields. And at the heart of that landscape is a debate over water. Yet, if you drive through Kings County, you may see a phantom lake. Tulare Lake was once considered the largest body of fresh water west of the Mississippi. But the lake was drained following decades of dams, canals, levees to support what is now billions of dollars of agricultural growth. This year, atmospheric rivers have bolstered the snowpack and dumped rain across the San Joaquin Valley, causing flooding and property damage across the Tulare Basin. But another consequence of all that water, Tulare Lake has reappeared. It is a rare sight that can be years, if not decades, in the making, bringing with it looming risks across the San Joaquin Valley. Mark Arax is a journalist and an author whose recent book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, is now available. And Mark joins us about the history of the region and its impact on California. Good morning, Mark. Nice to hear from you again.
Nice to be with you again, Vicki.
So you have written extensively about the Central Valley region, but one topic that is at the forefront of news today is the impact of these atmospheric rivers on the Tulare Basin, leading to the reemergence of Tulare Lake. What prompted your interest in this region?
Well, I happen to live here, and what we're witnessing right now is one of the great California dramas of man versus nature. And to appreciate, you know, what a story it is, you have to know a little bit of history. So, I'd like to kind of go back to, let's say, 1840. Let's pick 1840. California is still a part. It's a Mexican colony, right? And we're 6 years before the United States seizes California from Mexico and 10 years before the gold rush. And Tulare Lake is the most dominant feature on the California map. It's anywhere between 600 and 800 square miles. And there are four distinct tribes of Yokut Indians who live along its shores. There's the Tachi and the Chunut and the Wowo. And the lake is shallow, so the women scour for mussels with their toes, and the men float in these tule rafts, these rafts made of bulrushes, and there's a hole carved in the middle of them, and they spear fish from it. They've been living this way for, you know, thousands of years. So what happens then is the American settler after the gold rush comes to this part of California, and they grab these four rivers, the Kings, the Cahuilla, the Tule, and the Kern. Now, these rivers do not empty into the Pacific Ocean like the Sacramento and the San Joaquin. They end in this lake bottom. And so what they do is they grab these four rivers, and by feet of dam, canal, ditches, and pumps, they turn the Sierra snowmelt into this crisscross of irrigation. And it becomes one of the most engineered landscapes in the world.
When you're talking about 600 to 800 square miles, what once was Tulare Lake, I mean, that is more than four times the size of Lake Tahoe. And just listening to you describe what existed more than a century ago, it seems like not only another time, but just another planet, another California.
Beautifully said. I mean, this is a place of great migratory birds. The settlers said that when they alighted, they took off. It sounded like the roar of a freight train. Okay, and what they ended up doing is they ended up taking this implement, the Fresno scraper, and they flattened the earth so that hardly rose or fell an inch. They created almost like a billiard table. That's how flat, so the irrigation waters could move across it without impediment. And so they erased that marshland, and then they erased the lake itself eventually by 1920. And two families came out from the south. These were the Boswell family, the predominant family. They were cotton growers who were chased out of the South by the boll weevil. And in 1920, Colonel J.G. Boswell started claiming the lake bottom. And he planted the richest cotton patch in the world. So this is what happened here. The rub of all that was that every 20 years or so, nature would find its way past the canals and ditches and the pumps that made the rivers run backward, and the lake would return. And this is what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. I was reading an op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times back in January, and you said that you've been through, you know, a handful of floods, you know, since the 1960s, I believe 8, but who's counting when it comes to
yes.
flood years? But given that experience, you really have this front row seat to these pendulum swings, and you have witnessed the benefit as well as the devastation that that can cause. What has this taught you about human development, farming, agriculture, and how it relates to California and California's story?
Well, this is California's story. It's a grand act of hubris. I mean, taking this landscape 1,000 miles long and drawing the borders of a state around it. And inside that state are 10, 11 different states of nature. And we tried to conquer them all. And then we had this difference in water. It fell in the north, but most of the people lived in the South. And so we decided that we're going to even out those differences by creating the grandest hydraulic, you know, water moving system in the history of man. I know we're using a lot of greatest and mosts, but that is the story of California. It's a story of superlatives. You know, right now I'm getting these calls and emails from readers who have read The King of California and The Drempland from around the country. And they're following this drama of the lake coming back. And some of them are even rooting for nature to outflank man and see Tulare Lake alive again. But there's a human devastation with this too. I was down a few weeks ago in the little town of Allensworth. I mean, to call it a town is probably too much. It's a settlement. It's a colony. This is where the first freed slaves from the South came west in the early 1900s and found this place. The problem is Allensworth was sitting in an alkali bed, salt bed, and the water was full of arsenic. So it quickly kind of dried up, but folks are living there now. And this is a place of real history. We have a state park there. And so one piece of history, Tulare Lake coming back, is now impacting another piece of history, Allensworth. And the people there are fighting to stave off this flood. And come May, we're going to see a snow melt that we've probably never seen in a century or so.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Oh, we actually had a conversation touched upon that yesterday about what was called basically a slow-moving disaster. I mean, there's already been extensive flooding in the Central Valley after the series of atmospheric rivers at the beginning of the new year. You know, I spoke with Jeffrey Mount with the PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California, yesterday, and he was the one who called this kind of the slow-moving disaster. And he explains that this time around, the groundwater extraction over the past decade has lowered portions of the Tulare Basin, creating subsidence. And that, in turn, is creating these unanticipated impacts when compared to previous flood years, like back in the 1980s. You know, how is Kern and other surrounding counties, how are they preparing, knowing, I mean, you know what's coming, and I'm sure they know what's coming as well.
Yeah, Jeffrey Mount is one of the best experts on California water and a friend of mine. And what he says is correct. Subsidence, you know, we take out an immense amount during drought. We had basically got through the 10 years of it with this flood. And that's the story of California. You know, we move from years of drought to flood. It's kind of a whipsaw. And then on top of that, you bring climate change and all bets are off, right? And so what we're seeing now is, you know, the unpreparedness of these counties and stuff for this. I mean, you know, there's a kind of arrogance when you've defeated, subdued a lake. I mean, look at, you know, when the dams were put in the 1940s and 50s, the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, declared the bottom of a lake a flood zone. And they set about, and they invented this word. I don't know, you know, they set about to dewater the lake. Well, that is an act of, you know, it's an act of great guile and will and arrogance. So, you know, some people choose to see this as a kind of comeuppance. The old timers, I will give them this, the original Boswells and Salyers, they had respect for the lake coming back, and they would not plant permanent crops down there. They planted cotton, they planted tomatoes. But the new owners of the land, and some of them aren't even of this place, okay? They you know, they're hedge funds and pension funds and things like that. I mean, John Hancock has planted thousands of acres of pistachios down there. And we have other uses. We've got dairies that have come. I mean, mega dairies don't, you know, there's an argument that mega dairies don't belong in California because they pollute the groundwater and they use so much water. They certainly don't belong in the bottom of a lake bottom. And then the other thing is we have Los Angeles sending its human sludge over to the west side of the lake bottom. And you know, this is a toxin. It's spread on the land. I mean, they bring their, you know, their stuff over the mountain and spread it on the west side of Tulare Lake. So as this water's coming back, you're seeing dairy waste and the sludge, the human sludge from LA polluting the land. So we don't know what's coming in the next weeks and months.
It's difficult to visualize since it's decades in the making, but I think the best way that helped me visualize was in 1983, there were two kayakers who actually kayaked from the banks of the Kern River just outside of downtown Bakersfield all the way to the San Francisco Bay. I think it took a couple weeks. I mean, that just shows how vast and how large this basin and Tulare Lake is.
Yeah, you know, this land alternated between, you know, severe drought and wet. And in a wet year, you could take these boats, and if you traveled rivers and lakes, you could go all the way from Bakersfield to the San Francisco Bay. I saw the lake come back in 97. It wasn't as big as the 69 flood or the flood in 83, but it was quite something to see. I mean, I remember taking the highway out of Fresno to Corcoran, ending up at the base of this levee, okay? And this is a levee you might see in the Mississippi Delta. It's a kind of engineering that you might see in Holland. And as I climbed atop it, the smell of the air changed, the sound changed, as I looked across what was cotton land just a few weeks before. It was this expanse of water. I might as well have been in the New Jersey shore. And the wind was whipping white caps past the telephone poles. And if you look closely at the telephone poles, you could see the marks of previous floods. And the speed with which nature found itself was stunning. I mean, there was shorebirds, trying to hunt fish. And so it was, you know, it was so stunning. I mean, I got dizzy with vertigo, I remember. And that was the beginning of my my search into what was this place? What was this lake? And that ended up leading to a book that I co-wrote with Rick Wortsman called The King of California, about the J.G. Boswell secret empire.
When I think about what humans have done to California, you know, for agriculture, for water needs as our population grows, and the water infrastructure that was built and essentially changed the landscape of California. I think of other lakes like Mono Lake or Owens Lake, but is Tulare Lake unique in its own circumstances, or are there other areas comparable with similar conditions?
Well, I think Tulare Lake has a unique history, yes. That doesn't take away from, you know, the other lakes. I mean, let's face it. The example for all of this was Los Angeles. I mean, it ran out of its Puny River pretty early in its development, and it went up and over the mountain 230 miles to Owens to steal their river. And now LA, you know, it wants to grow. It wants to grow suburbia across desert. And the farmers here are growing, you know, crops on ground that is no longer prime ground. I mean, they went from, you know, growing the footprint of agriculture on the best ground to then the kind of medium ground. And now, because of drip irrigation, the wonders of drip irrigation, they're able to claim the worst ground. And so the footprint of agriculture has moved beyond what is sustainable. And it's the same story of how we plant suburbs in the path of wildfire. I mean, you look at Paradise. Paradise, what an irony. I mean, 40,000 people living on this geological chimney right in the path of wildfire. So we tempt nature. This is what we do in this state. And man's will is, you know, you could admire it, but you could also see a great tragedy and lesson in it. And that's what we're seeing now. Nature has the last word, as the cliche goes.
Mark, finally, the last time you joined us, you were talking to us and teaching us about how the Armenian diaspora has shaped the Central Valley. These are fabrics of our state of California that many people are unaware of, and Tulare Lake is yet another for many people. What do you hope people take away from your writing?
Well, I just keep digging into the earth here, and it keeps telling me new stories. This is a story of how the plantation came west. Okay, we transplanted the plantation west. These southern growers brought their mint juleps. They brought their black cotton pickers, and then the Latino cotton pickers came, and the white oaky cotton pickers came. And this is the story of this place. It's you know, it's an incredible canvas, the middle of the state particularly. And I keep threatening to leave, but the stories are too compelling. So I just think there's a lot that the earth teaches us if we dare to dig into it.
Well, I think I speak for a lot of us. Thank you for staying and continue digging into the earth. Mark, thank you so much. It's always wonderful speaking with you.
Okay, thank you, Vicky. You take care.
And more importantly, learning from you as well. Mark Arix is a former LA Times journalist and author who has written multiple books extensively about the history of the Central Valley. His latest book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, is a national bestseller. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Over the weekend, the city of Sacramento hosted a kickoff event for National Poetry Month, and there were some heavy hitters invited to perform. There is California Poet Laureate Lee Herrick, Stockton Poet Laureate Tamara Brisbane, and Sacramento Poet Laureate Andrew Defy. They all came together for the celebration and to really honor the spoken word of artists from all over the state. National Poetry Month is actually the largest literary celebration in the world. It celebrates celebrates and it highlights the importance of poetry in our culture and in our lives. And Sacramento has a deep history with poetry. From slam poetry to spoken word, theatrical and hip-hop, there really is no limit to the blend of poetry that has taken root and sprouted here at the state capitol. Joining us to explain the history of poetry and its future is Sacramento's very own poet laureate, Andrew Defy. Good morning. Nice to see you.
Good morning. So happy to be here.
We cannot wait to hear some of your work in just a few minutes. But first, let's learn about Poetry Month and the roots here in Sacramento.
Yeah, it's this has been going on for a long time. And Sacramento is such a hotbed and a wealth of poetry and history out here, you know, from Mahogany Urban Poetry to Luna's Cafe to the Sacramento Poetry Center. There's so much out here. And now continuing with the new generation with Sacramento Area Youth Speaks and some of the young people out here making a lot of history.
That is wonderful. I mean, and it's an important reminder because Sacramento actually has ties to some very famous poets like Amanda Gorman. Her grandmother lives in the Sacramento area, Brandon Lake. These probably are not just the only two.
No, absolutely not. I was talking to an elder last night who was like, hey, I studied under Maya Angelou at Sac State.
Wow.
So, you know, Sacramento has deep, deep roots. And then, you know, the last National Youth Poet Laureate, Alexandra Wynn, actually comes from Sacramento. She's a Sacramento Area Youth Speaks alumni. So, you know, from the past to the future, we really do it all here in Sacramento.
So how has poetry evolved over the years and decades in Sacramento? What is modern day, like the version of poetry, and how does it compare with what maybe some people might think, the older vintage type of art form?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the page and the stage, and both of these things still exist and are still evolving. Currently, the stage is really this, what they call slam poetry, which is the more theatric performance. When you see a Brandon Leak who won America's Got Talent in 2020, that's a great example of slam poetry. And Sacramento is such a, has so many amazing slam poets really carrying that torch right now.
When did poetry begin for you?
Poetry began for me probably 13 years old, I think I started writing, had just some big feelings and big emotions, was going through a lot in childhood. And I think that's where it starts for a lot of people. I was at a youth open mic last night at the Sacramento Poetry Center, and just hearing the young people express themselves and some of those big feelings and being able to just kind of process them. And I think that's where a lot of us start in poetry.
Given that there's obviously a tight-knit community here when it comes to poets, if someone wants to dip their toe in, they want to take it in, do you have any recommendations for local organizations people can attend?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the Sacramento Poetry Center is a great place to start. There's been some really amazing work done the last few years to make that into a space for everyone and to take accountability for times when it was an older white establishment that poetry can sometimes be. So there are open mics every Monday night at 7:30. Like I said, last night we had a youth open mic. Next week we are having the elders, who I think they said 340 years of poetry between them. There's some I think we have a 90-year-old, 102-year-old, so it really is for everyone.
Yeah. What if someone wants to grow their craft?
Yeah, there's all kinds of writing workshops. I actually heard last night there's a new one that's going to be starting up on Friday nights, I believe. This is just a space to write and to be together with other poets. You know, that's part of the idea of bringing everyone together, is the elders have so much to teach the younger generation, and the young generation has so much fire and passion to reignite some of us who've been writing for a long time.
Yeah, you're talking about such a wide range of generations. I'm just trying to visualize it. I imagine it never gets old and there's always inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the mentorship really comes in. You know, we have elders in this community who can just slice you open with 10 words, you know, the mastery of the craft. And you've got young people that their passion will send you home to write. No matter what time the event is over, I'll go home and pick up a pen because it sparks that kind of fire in you.
And you are now Sacramento's Poet Laureate. How does that feel?
Oh, my God. It's the greatest honor in my life, you know. I've always wanted to be a poet. I've always been a poet. And when I found out there was a Poet Laureate and that was a thing, I was like, that's what I want to do with my life. So for me, it is a life's dream, you know. And being able to, for me, it's a, you know, a lot of times it's a lifetime achievement award. For me, it's a working title. And I think being able to advocate for the poets in this city and to be able to advocate for equity and diversity and representation for the poets in this community has been really important. And we're making some real headway and creating some beautiful spaces for everyone to come together. This weekend being a primary example of that multicultural, multi-generational poetry space that looks like Sacramento.
This weekend?
Yeah. Yeah. This past weekend, we kicked off National Poetry Month with not one, not two, but three poet laureates and a bunch of the other poets as well. We've been doing a thing called Guerrilla Poetry out here for a long time. And so we got to bring some of that in. And Lee Herrick, the California Poet Laureate, was like, yo, what was that? That was amazing. And it's something that's, you know, it's not only Sacramento, but it's a very Sacramento style of poetry where people just kind of pop up from each corner of the event. But, you know, looking out, we had, you know, a couple hundred people and every style of poetry, every culture, every corner of the city represented. And Sacramento, a lot of times, we like to tout our diversity, but it's very siloed and it's very segregated. You know, the older folks read over here, the Black community reads over here, the boho community reads here, and the academics read over here. And I think everybody was in the same space. And, you know, that's what the Sacramento Poetry Center should be, is the center of Sacramento poetry. And it really, really was. And it was a beautiful reintroduction to that space.
Before we listen to one of your pieces, describe your style of poetry.
You know, I come from hip hop. I was a rapper before I was the Poet Laureate. So there's definitely, you know, rhythm in the roots. And then I kind of turn to slam poetry. But, you know, recently I've been working on these shorter poems that lean a little less on rhyme and just exploring. I love the written word. And again, I have, you know, the first Poet Laureate of the city, Viola Spencer. That's grandmother poetry to me. And so I've really like gotten a chance to study her work and the work of, you know, poets like Jose Montoya, who was huge out here, and just really like dive into, you know, expanding my own form a little bit. Like I said, I love all of it and I love to be able to relate to people and learn from all of the poets in this city. I'm not the best poet in this city, but you won't find anyone in this city who loves poetry more than me.
Well, let's take a listen. Let's hear Do You See It Yet? It was our managing editor's favorite.
Yeah, let me pull that up. I wrote this during the pandemic when I was just scrolling one day and I felt like a lot of people just didn't feel like they were enough. And I think a lot of us struggle with that. So I wrote this one for you. You are enough. Divinity flows in your fingertips with light so radiant, every beat of your heart a victory march. Made of whole universes, stitched by the hands of creation with flawless design, a prophecy you fulfill perfectly with every breath. You. The sun wouldn't shine the same without it. Creation is only waiting for you to smile back at it. Do you see it yet? You are enough for the birds to sing about, for the seeds to sprout about, for the stars to shoot about. Do you see it yet? Gardens in your speech, fields of wildflowers in your prayers, lighthouses in your eyes. No one else can see it for you. You have always been enough. You will always be enough. your simple act of being is enough. Do you see it yet?
That's beautiful, and it really captures how you couldn't write that and just keep it to yourself. And that's what poetry is, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, when people ask me what poetry is and what it's for, I think it's to take some of these huge feelings and these huge ideas and be able to make them bite-sized and make them processable. And when I watched how people were struggling in the isolation and with their mental health during the pandemic, finding a way to just really breathe some life and some love into my community through the spoken word, that, you know, that felt like what I was supposed to be doing as the poet laureate, as the lockdown laureate. So, you know, that's absolutely what the poetry is for.
Yeah, there's a great deal of compassion and empathy in what you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so universal, you know, and every once in a while I have to remind myself to turn that one back on myself. I'll read it as like, I am enough, right? Again, speaking that life and love into the community, and empathy is such a big part of the poetry.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Andrew Defy is Sacramento's Poet Laureate. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.